A quiet celebration is held in North Korea. It's Monday, September 11th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us too online at Facebook for VOA Asia. Also ahead, fire and firearms, the focus in Australia. Protesting treatment of Rohingyas. Cambodia's history put on film. An app to curb food waste. And time for technology. It's all on today's VOA Asia. North Korea marked the 69th anniversary of its founding Saturday with typical ceremonies and a fanfare as the international community watched for another potential missile test. The South Korean government said it was closely monitoring activity in the north as speculation mounted about another missile launch that could be connected to the commemoration of the establishment in 1948 of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Earlier in the week, South Korea said it had seen signs of preparation for another missile test, with South Korea's prime minister calling the situation very grave. By late Saturday, though, no test had been detected. North Korea has a history of using its military technology to mark significant holidays. Last year on this date, North Korea tested its fifth nuclear device. The anniversary comes this year, just a week after North Korea launched its sixth most powerful nuclear test. James McKeon, a North Korea policy analyst at the Center for Arms Control in Washington, tells VOA it would not have been surprising if the country had prepared some kind of missile or nuclear test to mark the holiday this year. Even if it had, he said it would not have been a major development in the already tense relationship between North Korea and the United States. Tom Plant, Director for Proliferation and Nuclear Policy at RUSI, says while North Korea's advancement is ultimately to keep the Kim regime in power, the Trump administration needs to do more, and the international community has yet to get beyond sanctions.
Well, I think his end game is to stay in power, to keep North Korea the shape and way it is at the moment, which means deterring US-led regime change. I mean, they saw the examples of Iraq and Libya and what happened to dictators there who gave up nuclear weapons programs or alleged nuclear weapons programs. I would say that Trump's response to this issue has been less than stellar so far. There's still time for him to improve, but given that his first act, or one of his first acts, was to throw insults at one of his closest allies in the region, South Korea, I'm not sure that he's got off to the best start. He seriously needs to improve from this point on. China's response, as ever, is key. But I see no indication that their fundamental strategic calculations have changed. I mean, their policies towards North Korea is the three no's. No war, no instability, and no nukes in that order, which means they won't take any action until that policy changes that threatens instability or war in the pursuit of getting rid of nukes. The community isn't unified. So it's impossible to think of a policy response that will itself be unified as a result. The second thing is, if the response is sanctions, it's important to think about two different kinds of sanctions. The economic coercion that the US wants to place on North Korea and the counter-proliferation sanctions that will stop North Korea selling its technologies to other countries or buying equipment and so forth that will help it develop faster.
A South Korean Defense Ministry spokesman told the French news agency there had been no signs Saturday of further preparations for a missile launch. He said North Korea has the ability to fire ballistic missiles from mobile launchers, so the South Korean military is maintaining its utmost defense posture, keeping a close watch over the North. According to McKeon, the North has the technology to launch missiles from almost anywhere in the country and has used tactics in the past to try to evade detection from international intelligence services. The South Korean Yonhap news agency quoted an unidentified government official as saying that the North could carry out a seventh nuclear test at its Punggye-ri test site at any moment, and it may hold another nuclear test in October to coincide with the founding anniversary of the ruling Workers' Party. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Rohingya rebels call for humanitarian ceasefire. Cambodian opposition party to boycott parliament vote on leader. Wife of detained Taiwan activist to attend his trial in China. United Nations experts say North Korean illegal exports over 6 months worth $270 million. YouTube removes North Korean propaganda channel. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. You can also find us on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Australians have surrendered more than 400 guns a day under a firearms amnesty that began in July. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney the weapons turned in include several high-powered military assault rifles, as well as shotguns from the Vietnam War 50 years ago.
This is the first national no-questions-asked amnesty since one following a mass shooting in the state of Tasmania in 1996. 26,000 firearms have been handed in so far, much to the surprise of Australian officials. They'd not expected so many weapons to be surrendered during the three-month program. Law enforcement authorities have been worried that unwanted military-style rifles, pistols and shotguns could fall into the hands of extremists and criminal gangs. The New South Wales Assistant Police Commissioner is Dave Donoghue.
Because it is an amnesty, we don't know the history of those firearms. We're not running searches on those firearms, but certainly it is a potential there that those firearms could have been stolen or otherwise unlawfully obtained.
A similar amnesty followed the Port Arthur massacre in Tasmania more than 20 years ago. Measures enacted then also restricted possession of automatic and semi-automatic firearms. 35 people died when a lone gunman using a semi-automatic rifle attacked a former penal colony at Port Arthur, a popular tourist destination. It was the worst mass shooting in Australia's history. After the current amnesty finishes at the end of the month, anyone found with an unregistered firearm faces up to 14 years in prison or a very hefty fine. Surrendered weapons are destroyed. It's estimated there are more than 250,000 illegal guns in Australia, although officials concede the exact number is impossible to gauge. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Well, Phil Mercer has been very busy following another big story in Australia where firefighters are bracing for what they fear will be one of the worst brush fire seasons on record. They say warmer conditions have combined with a very dry winter to raise the threat level.
Australia had one of the warmest ever winters in 2017, and forecasters are predicting dry conditions for spring, prompting fears that the bushfires that rage every year will begin earlier than usual. Traditionally, summer and autumn are the most dangerous periods in the heavily populated southeast of Australia. The annual fire season in the state of Victoria is now 50% longer than it was in the past, while emergency crews in New South Wales fought 2,500 fires in the winter month of August. Large aerial fire bombers have already arrived in preparation for a severe fire season. In Queensland, a tropical cyclone which dumped huge amounts of rain earlier this year has led to a rapid growth in vegetation that has since dried out, posing a huge fire risk. Early season bushfires are continuing to burn near the Queensland capital, Brisbane. Craig Lapsley, the Emergency Management Commissioner in Victoria, warns that dangerous times lie ahead.
We're already seeing some fires in the very eastern part of Victoria be difficult to manage, and that's in winter, moving into spring. So I think it's very clear for all of the states, particularly the southern states, the eastern seaboard, where the communities live, that we've got a very high risk. The early indicators are telling us to take this very serious, is my view.
Southeastern Australia is one of the most fire-prone regions in the world. Many bushfires are sparked by lightning strikes, while others are set accidentally by machinery or discarded cigarettes. Some are the work of arsonists. Many of Australia's native plants burn easily. Bushfires tend to occur when eucalyptus trees, which have a high oil content in their leaves, have dried out, usually following periods of below-average rainfall. In the summer of 2003, bushfires devastated parts of the nation's capital, Canberra. In 2009, a bushfire disaster known as Black Saturday killed 173 people in Victoria. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un hosted a massive celebration to congratulate his nuclear scientists and technicians who steered the country's sixth and largest nuclear test a week ago. No fresh provocations were spotted, while numerous events were held to mark the 69th anniversary of North Korea's founding on Saturday. Stay up to date with VOA You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always glad to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thanks for joining us today. As the United Nations reports nearly 300,000 Rohingya have fled their homes in Myanmar, protests have taken place around the world over the crisis. VOA's Kate Pound Dawson tells us that even the Dalai Lama and South African rights leader Desmond Tutu have weighed in, seeking better treatment for the Muslim minority group.
Demonstrators in Jakarta Friday protest against the Myanmar government, shouting, "God is great." In Afghanistan's western Herat province, protesters demand an end to violence against the Rohingya. And in Islamabad, protesters stomp on pictures of Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The United Nations says about 270,000 people have fled Myanmar's Rakhine state in the past 2 weeks after a group calling itself the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army attacked several police posts. Rohingya refugees say the military and members of Myanmar's Buddhist majority then attacked their villages. There are reports of the military killing women and children and destroying villages. The crisis has drawn the attention of world figures.
Those people, you see, who sort of harassing some Muslim, then they should remember Buddha. I think such circumstances, Buddha helping, definitely help to those poor Muslim. So still I feel that.
On Friday, South Africa's Bishop Desmond Tutu, like Aung San Suu Kyi, a Nobel Peace Prize recipient, issued a letter on social media urging her to speak out on behalf of the Rohingya and for justice and human rights. Myanmar's government considers the Rohingya economic migrants, not citizens, although most families have been in the country for generations. But this week, Aung San Suu Kyi said her government will implement a UN-approved plan to improve conditions for the Rohingya.
Everything can't be done at the same time, but the recommendations that are aimed at bringing about harmony and peace and rapid development, we shall be addressing them as quickly as possible.
Some experts say that while Myanmar's government must be held to account for the crisis, blaming Aung San Suu Kyi entirely won't help, given that she leads a fragile new democracy, which is dominated by a powerful military. Kate Pound Dawson, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia, Nancy Hatch Dupree, a prolific American expert on history, art, and archaeology of Afghanistan, died Sunday at the age of 90 after battling an illness in a Kabul hospital. Dupree arrived in the country in 1962 as a diplomat's wife and dedicated the rest of her life to collecting and preserving the war-shattered country's cultural heritage. Visit VOA Asia Facebook for the latest. This is VOA Asia. We continue now with VOA Asia. As modern Cambodia strives to move beyond the dark period of the Khmer Rouge and films like The Killing Fields focus on that brutal and deadly time in the late 1970s, Anchor Awakens, A Portrait of Cambodia, is an emotional film that traces Cambodian history from ancient times up to the present. VOA Khmer reporter Sophie Dafai spoke with director and producer Robert H. Lieberman about the film. He's a novelist, filmmaker, and member of the physics faculty at Cornell University. Sophie Dafai asked Lieberman what he meant by the phrase, Angkor Awakens.
It is essentially talking about how I think that Cambodia has come out of a very dark period. And it's awakened from, of course, the Pol Pot regime. So it's the awakening. And I find it among the young people, the older generation, you know, those who lived through the Khmer Rouge period, are rather damaged and fearful, whereas the young are awakening, and I think they're becoming, among other things, politically active, and I think they're much more optimistic than their parents. So that's, I think, the awakening.
What are the main takeaways the audience can learn from your film?
That's a tough question. I think, you know, documentaries often have a character that you follow or a group of people you follow. The character in this film is the country of Cambodia. And we're going to take you on a journey. We're going to take you from ancient Angkor through the French colonial period or protectorate period, you know, through, you know, the Vietnam War, Pol Pot, and then ultimately the Vietnamese, you know, entering Cambodia, overthrowing, you know, the Khmer Rouge. We're going to take you through right up to the present day and into the future. Why do you want to watch it? Well, it's not just educational. I think it's entertaining, but also it's a rather emotional film. I showed it to some of my students at Cornell, and they were crying.
You talk a little bit about the problems that Cambodia faces right now, like the education is not good, the healthcare is not good. So can you give the main problem that Cambodia is facing right now?
I can give it to you in one word. Mm-hmm. I think education. If you have an educated populace, things get better. The educational level is terrible. I mean, those who have money can go to good schools, but the rest of the country doesn't have that. One thing I've noticed that maybe other people haven't noticed is that nobody reads here. They don't read books. And this is kind of shocking to me as a teacher. You know, I don't see people carrying books. I don't see people reading books. Cambodians are not readers. And that is very disturbing. And that's part of education. You need to create the population that reads. It's through reading that you get really information, by reading from many different sources. So if you educate the children, that's the future of the country. By the way, the biggest resource of a country is not its mineral wealth. It is not its timber wealth or its agricultural wealth. The wealth of a country, the greatest resource, is the young people. And you have to take care of them. You have to, you know, ensure their health and their education.
Thank you very much for joining VOA Khmer interview.
It was my pleasure.
Robert H. Lieberman is producer and director of the film Angkor Awakens, A Portrait of Cambodia. We visit a Cambodia cultural festival here in Washington, which you can see right now on VOA Asia Facebook, and we'll hear more on tomorrow's VOA Asia program. This news alert from VOA Asia: the world's largest auto market, China, is joining France and Britain in announcing plans to end sales of gasoline and diesel cars. China's industry ministry is developing a timetable to end production and sale of traditional fuel cars and will promote development of electric technology. Steer your way to VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, here's a statistic for you to consider. The United Nations estimates that over 30% of the food that's produced every year never gets eaten. That's 1.3 billion metric tons of food, more than enough to feed the world's 700 million plus hungry people. VOA's Kevin Enix reports one enterprising Nigerian entrepreneur has built an app to help get some of that food to those who need it.
The creator of the Chowberry app has a clear motivation for creating his new food-sharing application.
There was a phase in the family where my dad was temporarily ill and out of work. And I remember vividly during that time period, the challenge at home was access to a wholesome meal, a quality meal. We could go a day or two without having a quality meal.
He wants to try and make sure other kids don't have to go through what he went through.
This was something that affected me psychologically and also impacted on my academics. And I always said sometime in the future, I would resolve this problem. I would leverage my abilities and capacities to ensure that others don't go through what I went through.
Rather than ending up in landfills, food that has passed its best buy date is still safe to eat and fresh. The app allows store owners to upload information on the food they can't sell. Charities buy the food they need at a discounted price and deliver it to those who need it.
It's so difficult for me to get food to feed my family because I don't have work to do. So it was people's help that I managed to feed my children. But now things will be better for me.
The app is good for everyone because food stores make a small profit by selling food they would normally throw away.
The long-term goal is to have this platform evolve into a big data platform, and our value proposition is simple. Simply plug the waste that is going on the food value chain and redirect what would have been wasted to those that need it the most.
By the end of 2018, Ekpanimo says his app will feed 100,000 households. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Getting around, easier with disabilities, and easing concerns about nuclear energy. It's all on Time for Technology with VOA Asia's David Byrd.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd in Washington, and this is Time for Technology. Getting around, particularly if you have a physical disability, can be a huge challenge. But as Kevin Enix tells us, solving that problem has led to some innovative and cheaper electric vehicles.
Researchers at Cairo's Helwan University wanted to create a vehicle to help disabled students move around campus. So we started to look at what's available on the market and what the country is doing for them, and we found that there are electric wheelchairs or manual wheelchairs, but these chairs don't allow people to go long distances. This remote-controlled, solar-powered car solves that problem. So we decided to make them a three-wheeled car. They can go long distances with it. They would not need anybody to help them drive it or to stop it. Meanwhile, get ready for the Arcimoto, coming from the U.S. state of Oregon. It's a three-wheeled electric vehicle designed to be a commuter car.
I thought, you know, if we could build something that was much closer to the motorcycle in terms of efficiency and fun factor and, you know, footprint on the road, but was close to the car in terms of capabilities and enclosable and carries groceries and stable, that we'd have a real product opportunity.
Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Nuclear power plants help to light our world, but many people are also wary of them because of recent nuclear accidents. Michelle Quinn tells us about one group of women who is helping to ease the concerns of people living near nuclear power plants.
Fukushima, Chernobyl, Three Mile Island. Nuclear energy disaster sites that critics use to advocate closing all nuclear power plants. They say the risk of radiation are too great. But plants are closing anyway because of the availability of cheap natural gas, greater energy efficiency, and public safety concerns. To address those concerns, the industry is turning to powerful advocates of their own, women who work in nuclear power, to help change attitudes of other women who tend to be more skeptical than men about nuclear energy's benefits. Kristen Zates and Heather Madison work at California's Diablo Canyon Power Plant. The two started Mothers for Nuclear, a group to promote the environmental benefits of nuclear energy.
As mothers, I think we also have an important role to play in letting the public know that we support nuclear for the future and for our children.
Mothers for Nuclear's message comes as few new plants are being built. For VOA News, this is Michelle Quinn in San Francisco.
For more on these stories, visit voanews.com. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. We'd like to remind you that our program is available in many different places, like iTunes and SoundCloud. You can download us as a podcast and take VOA Asia with you wherever you go. You, of course, can find us at our website, voanews.com, and we're on Facebook at VOA Asia. We invite you to join us there anytime you like. You can send us a message as well. We'd love to hear from you. We'd also like to say hello to everybody listening via Facebook on VOA Burmese in Myanmar. Thanks for joining us today. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Aydin Utku, managing editor Diane Gao, Ali Ogden, David Byrd, and Ira Melman are on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We wish you a great day.